No one wants to lose their child at a young age. But in Michigan, it's a reality too many parents face.
I never understood this thing, you know, all things heal with time, because it doesn't feel any better at all. Not even a little bit.
All the babies that you're taking care of are doing fine. Until one day, you walk in and you go, oh no.
From Michigan Radio, this is State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer Guerra. Too many Michigan babies die before they reach their first birthday, and too many of those babies have dark skin.
If white babies died at the rate black babies died, we would have a national emergency.
So what's being done about the state's high infant mortality rate? Over the next hour, we'll look at the problem as well as possible solutions. That's ahead on State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. But first, this news. I want to introduce you to a young mom. Her name is Angela. She's 21 years old, and she lives with her son in a two-bedroom Section 8 apartment. They live just outside Detroit in a city called Highland Park.
I have one kid.
Hello?
And one on the way. I'm going to say his name. His name is Darion. He's 3 years old.
Darion has a crazy amount of energy.
I know I'm going to have to put him on football or something.
He likes to bounce around his two-bedroom apartment like the springiest frog you've ever seen. He's also a very big fan of toy cars.
I'm playing my toy.
And soon, his mom tells me, Darion is going to be a big brother.
I'm pregnant now, and I'm 4 months. And I'll find out what I'm having today. I'm very, very excited. I pray it's a girl. I wonder how she's going to be.
Her attitude.
When you're pregnant, and you just imagine a lot of stuff. You imagine holding your baby. You have dreams about your baby. Because I had dreams about my baby. I had imagined a lot.
But no one imagines that their baby won't make it to their first birthday. Infant mortality is a big problem in Michigan. The ugly truth is, too many babies in Michigan are dying, and too many of those babies are children of color. I'm Jennifer Guerra with Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity. On today's show, we'll dig into the state's infant mortality problem and see what's being done to improve the health of all babies. Infant health is impacted by so many different factors: the health of the mother, access to healthy foods, safe environments. So what does it say about us that our infant mortality rate is one of the highest in the country? For every 1,000 babies born in Michigan, roughly 7 won't make it to their first birthday. That's a whole point higher than the U.S. infant mortality rate. When you break it down by race, the numbers are even more disturbing.
Actually, I gave birth in here. I went into labor in this room.
I met Shantania Smith on a hot summer day in August. She invited me over to her mom's house in Romulus near the airport. That's where she was babysitting her little brother, 2 cousins, and a niece.
Yes, 4 of them upstairs. They in the game room right now, so they be up there for it. They don't go come back down today once more popsicles.
Shantania is a shy, pretty girl, a junior at Eastern Michigan University. She's 20 years old, but she looks a lot younger. The bright yellow and green checkered sundress she's wearing makes her look more like she's 14. Which is how old she was when she met her boyfriend, Jerome. Shantania tells me they met in high school.
And then once we met in class, he had walked me to my bus, and we discovered we was getting on the same bus and off at the same stop.
They started dating almost immediately. 3 years later, when Shantania was a senior in high school, she got pregnant. When she found out, she enrolled in Medicaid. She took her prenatal vitamins, stayed in school. But 6 months into her pregnancy, her doctors discovered she had a short cervix. When she went into labor a month and a half later, the umbilical cord prolapsed and came out first, and Shantania was rushed to the hospital for an emergency C-section. On January 14th, 2010, she gave birth to a little baby boy named Jerome, JJ for short.
I actually just found out recently, I didn't even know this, that when my son was first born, they had to resuscitate him because he wasn't breathing when he was born. And he stayed in the hospital for, I think, maybe 6 weeks, and he came home, but he wasn't doing good, so I took him back to the hospital. So he stayed in for another week and came back when he was 8 weeks, and he ended up passing 2 weeks later.
JJ is among the 817 babies in Michigan who passed away in 2010. Today, there's a framed poster-sized picture of JJ hanging on the wall at Shantania's mom's house, and Shantania wears his ashes in a locket around her neck.
I talk to him a lot, almost on a daily basis. Sometimes a couple times a day, depending on what I'm going through that day.
What do you guys talk about?
Some of everything. Whatever's going on that day. Whatever is on my mind.
She has lots to talk with him about, like how she got a raise at work and went from making $8 an hour to $9 an hour. But that dollar raise put her just over the threshold for Medicaid, so she was cut off from insurance. Without insurance, she couldn't afford her birth control. And now she and Jerome are expecting again.
I'm kind of happy, but I don't know. I'm scared most of all. Well, my son, when he passed away here in the bed with us. So it's just like, I'm scared to go through all of that all over the whole thing. So it's hard. It's really hard to deal with. Because it's like I have so many people. I have a huge support system. But sometimes I really feel like I have nobody because I don't like to bring the pain back up in them. I don't like to see them cry as well. And I know if I bring it up, they're going to. So it's extremely hard. And it's been over 2 years and has not got better at all. So I never understood this thing, you know, all things heal with time, because it doesn't feel any better at all, not even a little bit.
In Michigan, how likely you are to survive your first year often depends on the color of your skin. Native American, Hispanic, and to a lesser degree, Arabic babies born in Michigan have a higher rate of infant death. But by far the biggest disparity is between black and white babies. African American babies, like JJ, are 2.5 times more likely to die before they turn one compared to white babies. In some Michigan cities, the disparity is even higher. In Battle Creek, for example, black babies are 5 times more likely to die than white infants in that city. In Kalamazoo, the gap is even wider. That's not to say the infant mortality rate in Michigan and the U.S. hasn't seen dramatic improvement over the past century. It has. The infant mortality rate in the U.S. has steadily dropped over the last couple decades. But compared to other countries, we're still not doing that well. Infants born in Cuba and Slovenia have a better chance of survival than babies born in the United States. One of the leading causes of infant mortality in the U.S. is preterm birth. And if you're like Shantania Smith and you have a short cervix, you are at a much higher risk for delivering early, which can lead to a whole host of issues for the baby, including growth and respiratory problems. But what if there was a way to delay women from having their baby too early? I met up with Dr. Sonia Hassan at Hutzel Hospital in Detroit at a place called
the Center for Advanced Obstetrical Care and Research at the Perinatology Research Branch.
Hassan is the medical director there. She also does a lot of research involving babies and pregnant moms. She recently helped spearhead a worldwide study involving more than 400 pregnant women and a particular type of gel called vaginal progesterone. All the women in the study were monitored very closely during their pregnancies, and they all received a vaginal ultrasound to see if they had a short cervix. Half of the women with a short cervix got a placebo. The other half got the gel.
Comparing those two, we found that the women who got the progesterone had a reduction in the rate of preterm birth of about 45%.
In other words, almost half of the women who used the progesterone gel did not deliver early. The gel cut the amount of preterm births by 45%.
They also had a reduction in the rate of respiratory distress syndrome. So, like, that's the most common complication you can have in a premature baby. So that was significant, too.
Hassan admits when she got back the results, she was kind of stunned. She didn't expect the gel to have that big an impact. And here's another thing. Not delivering early saves money. Hassan says if health providers screened 100,000 women a year to see if they had a short cervix during pregnancy and then gave those women the progesterone gel, those screenings would dramatically reduce healthcare costs.
So, for example, in the state of Michigan, we have 100,000 women who are pregnant every year. If we were to use that for all pregnant women in Michigan, we would save $19 million a year.
You mean because a preterm baby is going to have more health problems down the road or even right at the start?
Right, exactly. Right, and all of the problems that happen in the hospital and then afterwards are factored in.
Getting a transvaginal ultrasound to check your cervix is not standard protocol, and not all insurance companies cover it. But they're starting to. Here in Michigan, cervical screening will become standard for all pregnant women in their second trimester, and moms found to be at high risk will get the progesterone gel. But the gel is just one piece of the puzzle. Michigan's infant mortality rate is such a big problem that Governor Rick Snyder even included it on his dashboard of things he wants to address in his first term. And so this summer, the powers that be got together to come up with a plan to reduce Michigan's infant mortality rate. Olga Dazzo, the director of the Michigan Department of Community Health, introduced the plan at a news conference in Flint.
We have an important goal ahead of us, and we're going to need everyone's help to change the environment in Michigan so that our babies survive.
The plan Dazzo presented took a year to put together, and the process involved groups from across the state. The plan has 8 main strategies, including things like more progesterone treatments for high-risk moms, promote safe sleep positions for babies, better sex education for teens. The 8th strategy on the list is to look at the impact of community and the experience of racial minorities. The news conference to announce the plan was held at Hurley Medical Center in Flint. The location was picked because Hurley is one hospital that's already made some progress on reducing not only infant deaths, but also reducing the racial disparity in infant deaths. A doctor at Hurley named Larry Young said the efforts to reduce the racial disparity in birth outcomes go far beyond the hospital walls.
I see infant mortality as a community disease as well as a medical disorder. Too often we focus on the medical aspect and not the community aspect.
So exactly how does community play a role in reducing infant mortality? Well, I have 3 words for you.
The social determinants of health.
The social determinants of health
are those economic, social, contextual factors that influence a woman's ability to have a healthy pregnancy.
We'll unpack the social determinants of health in 10 minutes. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer Guerra. I'm standing in a place that no parent wants to find themselves in. I'm surrounded by lots of rooms with incubators and feeding tubes and tiny, tiny little babies. It's the neonatal intensive care unit, also known as
the NICU.
And I'm here with
Robert, call me Bob Schumacher. And I'm the medical director of the newborn intensive care unit at the University of Michigan. I'm a neonatologist. That's a fancy name for a pediatrician who plays in the newborn intensive care unit all day.
Can you tell me sort of what are the more common reasons why babies end up in the NICU?
Well, in most intensive care units across the country and in the state of Michigan, most babies are here because they're early. They're premature. The other reason we get a lot of babies here at the University of Michigan is because of congenital and problems with congenital anomalies. A baby who has a heart or an intestine or some organ system that's not built right. So prematurity, congenital anomalies are the 2 causes of infant mortality, big causes.
What do you tell parents when they come in here? I know it's different for every case, but I wonder if there is something you say that either calms them or gives them hope.
Well, yeah, I will often say, you know, it's a two-edged sword. I'm congratulations on the birth of your child, and I'm sorry you're here. The survival rate of most of our babies, even down to very little teeny tiny babies, is well into the 90% range. Which, if you were a parent, you'd say, oh, that's much better than I thought. But I'll think to myself, that means if it's 90%, 1 in 10 of you won't make it. The sad news is, oftentimes you don't know which one it is that isn't going to make it. That is, all the babies that you're taking care of are doing fine. Until one day, you walk in and you go, oh, no. It's like a meteor came down and just landed right in the middle of a baby's room.
Michael was born at 26 weeks, 1 pound, 4 ounces. He was so small that my husband could put his wedding ring on his wrist. And he lived to be 11 and a half months old. And he came home. We enjoyed him at home for 4 months before he passed away on a ventilator with a trach. And he had a feeding tube. It was definitely an emotional roller coaster. You know, in NICU, everything is something to hold on to. So if he drank 1 ounce of breast milk, that was, you know, a great accomplishment for him. So for him to live that long when the doctor said that he wouldn't even make it 24 hours was a blessing.
That was Ebony Evans at a park in Metro Detroit talking about her son, Mikhail Javon Evans. Ebony and her husband now have a healthy and happy 6-year-old daughter named Essence. So like Dr. Schumacher said, two of the main reasons babies end up in the NICU is because they're born too soon or too small. And a disproportionate amount of preterm and low birth weight babies are African American.
If white babies died at the rate black babies died, we would have a national emergency.
Dr. Carolyn Rowland runs the Maternal Infant Health Program for the city of Detroit, and she's part of a team of public health workers who get together once a month to talk about the ways to reduce the city's black infant mortality rate. She says the story of infant mortality doesn't start in the NICU. She says it starts much, much earlier.
Growing up, a woman of color in this society is toxic. Yes. It's toxic to you, to your physical health, your emotional health, your mental health, and therefore that impacts your reproductive capacity. So if, in fact, we really cared about all of our children, we would not allow women of color to grow up in a toxic soup.
Roland's toxic soup metaphor, part racism, part poverty, part inequity, isn't some fringe idea that she and a few liberal lefties cooked up. The data show that moms with little or no income, moms who live in troubled neighborhoods, moms who don't finish high school, and moms who receive inadequate prenatal care, they're all more likely to lose a child. But there's also a growing body of research that implicates racism in the black and white infant mortality disparity.
Jennifer.
Hello, how are you?
How are you?
That's Dr. Renee Branch Kamady. She heads up the Ingham County Health Department. Before that, she was a research professor at Michigan State University, where she did lots of studies on race and health disparities. Kamady, who, it seems worth noting, is black, lives in Lansing with her youngest son, 17-year-old Wesley. That's him playing piano. I met up with them at their house on a Saturday afternoon. It was chore day at the Kamady household.
Putting all the furniture back. We just finished getting the deck power washed and stained. Honey, the heavy one, is that the heavy one, rocker one?
Wesley's two older brothers are away at college, so lucky them, they get out of doing the household chores. But there is one other person missing from this scene, and that's Kamady's firstborn son.
My fourth son, my deceased son, is Mark Howard. We refer to him as Howard, used his middle name. This is my son.
Kennedy takes out a little photo album and starts showing me pictures of Mark Howard.
I know. I'm just a sweetie pie.
He was born premature.
Yeah, so this was his team, his nurse and all the neonatologists.
And he passed away when he was just 6 months old. It happened right around the time Kennedy went to grad school. So there she was, working on her dissertation. And the whole time, she kept turning the pregnancy over and over in her mind, asking herself,
what should I have done differently? What could I have done differently?
Those are very personal questions, and they ultimately ended up playing out in Kennedy's professional life. By the time Kennedy finished her PhD and joined Michigan State as a research professor, her focus was clear. She wanted to know why African-American babies have significantly worse outcomes than white infants.
Even when we controlled for economic status, there was still this unexplained difference in the pregnancy outcomes of women of color versus white women. And when the literature began to demonstrate that African-American women who were college educated still had worse outcomes than white women who had no high school diploma. And so with that, you begin to say, what is distinct in the lives of African-American women?
There's pretty strong evidence that genetics do not play a role in the disparity. So what does? Well, over the past two decades, lots of different theories have been presented and rejected. One that seems to be gaining more and more traction, though, is something called the social determinants of health.
Social determinants are those economic, social, contextual factors that influence a woman's ability to have a healthy pregnancy or to engage in the healthy behaviors needed to have a favorable pregnancy outcome.
In other words, where you live, work, and play, it all contributes to your chances of delivering a healthy baby. So let's say you live in a high-poverty urban neighborhood. You are more likely to go to a low-performing school. You're more likely to be exposed to drugs and violence, which can be stressful. You're less likely to have a nearby park or a place to exercise, less likely to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, and less likely to have good medical care. It all translates to less opportunity for the people living in these neighborhoods, many of whom are Black.
I mean, I always say the choices people make are determined by the choices people have. And many women live in settings where they don't have very good choices, or when good choices are available, they don't have the ability to respond because of a variety of social barriers in their lives.
Kennedy believes one of the biggest barriers women of color face is racism and the chronic stress that goes along with that discrimination. Not blatant, in-your-face racism. Kennedy says that's pretty rare these days. No. What she's talking about is more subtle. She calls it interpersonal racism, and she believes it's taking its toll on women's health. The effect of all that stress, it has a name. It's called weathering, and it was coined by this woman.
My name is Arlene Geronimus, and I'm a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan.
When Arlene Geronimus first published her weathering hypothesis in the 1980s, it didn't go over too well.
I was actually called at one point the biggest threat to youth in this country.
Today, her weathering hypothesis has gained a lot more traction. So here's her theory. Women of color experience chronic stress related to being Black and how they're treated. And these stressors over time, it prematurely ages the women or weathers them. So that by the time African-American women are in their 20s or early 30s, often considered prime childbearing years, their health has deteriorated so much that they're at greater risk for having a poor birth outcome, like premature birth or low birth weight.
Chronic stress means you're endlessly flooded with stress hormones. They don't go back to normal levels, and they do damage, you know, to your heart, to your blood pressure, to, you know, to your weight, to all, a variety of things we see as either precursors to poor health or our poor health themselves.
And weathering doesn't just take its toll on poor Black women. Geronimus says rich and middle-class African-American women experience it as well.
They're still dealing with stressors related to the contingencies of being Black and how they're treated. They're dealing with being tokens. They're dealing with having been raised in one way and then being part of a kind of institution that has unwritten, unspoken rules that you didn't get the memo, but everybody else seems to have the memo.
You're listening to State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer Guerra. We're looking at why infant mortality and infant mortality disparities are such a big problem in Michigan. There are a number of studies that implicate racism, broadly defined, in infant mortality disparities. Studies that compare white and Black mothers who lived in high-income neighborhoods, Black and Hispanic mothers who lived in low-income neighborhoods, Black and white moms who were obese. Across the board, Black mothers were at an increased risk for losing a child. But Harvard Health economist Amitabh Chandra isn't buying it. He says there is a lot more work that needs to be done before we can point the finger at racism and say it's a major cause in infant mortality disparities.
The bar for having demonstrated racism is much higher than saying, even when I control for, poverty status and college degree, there are persistent gaps in infant mortality. That doesn't tell me that it's racism. It just tells me I didn't do a particularly good job of measuring the quality of schooling or neighborhood circumstance. Now, maybe to some people that's racism, but to me it just means there's lots of other things in life we have to control for.
Blaming racism, he says, is a little premature. Chandra's open to the hypothesis that racism plays a part in infant mortality disparities. But in the end, he says, it's just that. A hypothesis.
I think we need to do a lot more work to understand exactly how racism and the experience of discrimination, how that affects, say, early onset of aging or stress or hypertension. I think we need to do more work there. I think what we have is a hypothesis with some really intriguing evidence around it, but I don't think we have like evidence that rises to the level of having firmly determined that this is why we see what we do.
To Chandra, things like education, neighborhoods, behaviors, those are things that can be empirically measured and have been shown to have an impact on health disparities. He is much less convinced that racism at the health provider level plays a big role in the disparities. But don't tell that to the people in this room.
Okay. Thinking over all the things that you saw and heard in the film, what stands out to you as particularly surprising or important?
About 15 people, mostly middle-aged, are sitting in a semicircle in the middle of a room in Charlotte, near Lansing. They've just finished watching part of a documentary which explores whether or not inequality makes people sick. The two people leading the health equity workshop are
Valerie Smith
and Doak Bloss.
They're with the Ingham County Health Department. The goal of their four-day workshop is to teach public health workers to treat everyone the same, regardless of race, age, or gender. The workshop is mandatory for everyone who works for the county's health department. Accountants, nutritionists, and medical staff, everybody has to participate. About 200 state-level public health workers have also taken the workshop.
Basically, we have these huge disparities that exist for people of color when compared to white people, for people of low socioeconomic status to higher socioeconomic status. And those disparities are consistent across populations, across the country. Infant mortality is one of the most obvious ones. In Ingham County, we've had as many as the rate has been five times higher that an African-American baby will die than a white baby.
To get at the root causes of why these disparities exist, Doak Bloss's workshop tackles all the biggies: racism, class discrimination, sexism. They talk about how those things can impact health and what to do about it. To help illustrate his point, Bloss likes to use a metaphor. So imagine two people standing on two different ladders. One person is doing better. They're higher up on the ladder.
The person who's doing better, that's a disparity. That's like the outcome is different for these two groups of people.
To talk about inequity, Bloss says you have to look at the ladder itself. The person who's doing better has a better ladder. The rungs are closer, so it's easier to climb.
Whereas the person on the ladder that has very few rungs is hanging on for dear life, can't think of how to get to that next thing, and some people have to work 10 times harder to get up that ladder. That's inequity. That's an unjust, unfair difference in opportunity, difference in access to resources.
Bloss isn't delusional. He understands that disparities in infant mortality and other health issues, they aren't going to vanish all of a sudden because of one mandatory 4-day workshop. But he says conversations are happening at his health department and at the state level that didn't used to happen. People are asking, are we treating our patients the way they need to be treated given their life circumstances? Change is not going to happen overnight. But if Doak Bloss were a betting man,
I would say it's a 20-year effort, honestly, to change the culture in the way that we want to.
But 20 years is a long time and a lot of potential lives lost. So what can be done now? What's happening today to ensure that all babies have an equal shot at celebrating their first birthday, no matter where they live, what color their skin is, how much money their parents have in the bank? Coming up, we'll look at a program that's trying to reduce infant mortality, not just by addressing what happens inside the hospital, but in the neighborhoods as well.
So, for instance, to address infant mortality, you provide the ability for women to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables in their neighborhood. Well, guess what? Other people in the neighborhood are going to benefit from access to fresh fruits and vegetables. If you have a safe environment where they can, you know, move more, guess what? The whole community benefits. The men, families, all of these different things, factors that we use that will help decrease the infant mortality rate are the same factors that will actually lift the whole a whole community in terms of its health status.
Solutions to the infant mortality problem, coming up in 10 minutes. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. This is State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer Guerra. This hour, we're digging into the question of why so many babies in Michigan die before their first birthday and what's being done to try to change that.
Hey, Melissa, are you going to come let us in? Okay, thanks. They don't have doorbells here, so I have to call her and have her come open the door.
I'm with Jenny Hall. She's a social worker in Genesee County, and she let me tag along with her on a home visit to see a client of hers who lives near Flint. The client is named Melissa. Like a lot of Hall's clients, Melissa is on Medicaid and receives federal and state aid.
She's 18 and has 3 small children, and we're going to go meet with her and see how she's doing as far as coping and what her goals are, what she's working on today.
Hall visits Melissa usually 3 or 4 times a month. The home visits are part of Healthy Start, a program designed to reduce infant mortality disparities in places with some of the worst birth outcomes. You know those forms you have to fill out, the ones that say, in case of emergency, who should we contact? Well, for a lot of Jenny Hall's clients, Jenny is their main support system. She's the one they call if they're in trouble. Melissa, no exception. Before we go in to meet Melissa, I asked Hall if she thinks what she's doing is making a difference in Melissa's life.
Well, at first it doesn't feel like it when you say, oh, she has 3 kids under the age of 18. But it is working. It really is. It is a long process for these girls to get out of the cycle they've been in for so long. So we consider the fact that her children are healthy, she's on birth control, she hasn't, you know, slipped into the negative mentality that she wants to stay on state aid. She will say, I'm not going to be like my family. I'm going to be the one to get out. I'm going to be able to support my kids someday. So in short term, it might not look like there's been a lot of change, but in her mind, her mindset, she's getting out of the cycle.
You're very invested.
I am.
Yeah.
You can really just see if you took a child and put them in your family, you know, versus how they've lived, just the outcome would be so much different. So we're just trying to give them the chance to have a positive outcome.
To help women like Melissa break out of the cycle of poverty and help their infants thrive, Healthy Start takes a holistic approach. I like to think of it as the Infant Mortality Reduction Dream Team. There's a nutritionist, a nurse, a social worker, and a community health worker. Together, they assess the needs of the mom and from there decide who should do the home visits. There is no cap on the number of home visits, so up until the baby turns 2, members of the Dream Team can visit clients every day if that's what's needed. During that time, social worker Jenny Hall and her colleagues, they try to help the women finish their education, get stable housing, and perhaps equally as important, they give the women a safe place to vent.
All right, so what's new?
On this particular home visit, Hall and Melissa talk about everything from housekeeping to how her two-month-old is doing.
Well, he got the sniffles right now, but he was breaking out real bad and he was constipated.
They talk about how Melissa can't afford daycare, and so she isn't sure when she'll be able to go back to school to get her GED. They talk about the projects where Melissa used to live and where most of her family still does.
There's at least a shooting every week there. It's not very safe, were they?
As she burps her little baby boy, Melissa tells Hall that she found out two of her friends from her old neighborhood just died.
They both got shot, and I didn't even know it.
Well, I'm glad you're out here where it's safe.
Yeah, I am too. Yeah, keep us out of harm's way, especially my kids, because I don't know what I'd do if something happens to them. I love them so much.
The funding for Healthy Start is a combination of state Medicaid dollars and a $750,000 federal grant. There are 6 Healthy Start programs in Michigan, with more on the way. Most are focused on African-American mothers and their children, but one program focuses on Michigan's Native American population. The Healthy Start program in Genesee County began over 10 years ago, when the African-American infant mortality rate there was nearly 4 times higher than the rate for white babies. According to their most recent data, the black infant mortality rate for Healthy Start babies in Genesee County is 0. 0 babies from the program died before their first birthday. And they don't cherry-pick ideal candidates to be in the program. The higher the need, the better. One community health worker I spoke to says she recruits women in line at Walmart.
A credit card, a debit card, or an EBT card?
Just the notion.
Over at a church in southwest Detroit, one group is using an old-fashioned baby shower to try to get women in the neighborhood to sign up for a new infant mortality reduction program. And what baby shower would be complete without baby shower games? At this one, 3 dozen moms play the purse game. You know the one? Somebody calls out a bunch of different items, and whoever has the most items on the list wins.
Picture or ultrasound? Picture or ultrasound?
The winner, in this case, gets to choose one of the baskets at the front of the room. The baskets are filled with diapers, onesies, stuffed animals. There are big-ticket items, too, like a diaper genie and a bassinet. Taped to each prize is a piece of paper that says, "Sew up the safety net" on the front. Sew Up the Safety Net is a collaboration between 4 Detroit-area health systems, and it's funded by a $1.8 million grant. Dr. Kimberly Dawn Wisdom with Henry Ford Hospital is spearheading the program. Now, it's pretty early in the game. They just started recruiting women. The goal is to sign up 1,500 at-risk women from 3 Detroit neighborhoods. The vast majority of the women will not be pregnant. The idea is to help the women long before they get pregnant so that they can improve their chances of having a healthy baby.
We know that a woman has to be healthy prior to her pregnancy, ideally. So having access to fresh fruits and vegetables and safe environments to exercise, a controlled blood pressure, a weight that is a healthy weight. Also, a mother that does not have a 12th grade education is also a contributing factor to a poor birth outcome and ultimately an infant death as well.
Sew Up the Safety Net uses something called a community health worker model. Community health workers are people on the front lines. They live in the neighborhoods where they work. So for Sew Up the Safety Net, each targeted neighborhood will have 2 community health workers. Wisdom calls them neighborhood navigators. The navigators will visit the women at their homes and talk with them about nutrition, education, health and wellness, family planning, and they'll serve as a link between the women and the various resources available to them, both social and medical. By addressing not just what happens inside the hospitals, but in the neighborhoods as well, Wisdom thinks they can start to move the needle on infant mortality
and improve the health of the whole community while they're at it.
So, for instance, to address infant mortality, you provide the ability for women to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables in their neighborhood. Well, guess what? Other people in the neighborhood are going to benefit from access to fresh fruits and vegetables. If you have a safe environment where they can, you know, move more, if you have better access to transportation for the women that are pregnant through bus lines and that sort of thing, the whole community benefits. All of these different things, factors that we use that will help decrease the infant mortality rate are the same factors that will actually lift the whole a whole community in terms of its health status.
The 1,500 women who will participate in Sew Up the Safety Net will be tracked over the next 3 years to see, one, if the community health worker approach works, and two, if it can be replicated. You're listening to State of Opportunity. This hour, we're looking at why infant mortality is such a problem in the state and what's being done about it. I'm Jennifer Guerra. Infant mortality and infant mortality disparities aren't just a problem in Michigan. They're a problem across the country. That's why the Obama administration is coming up with a federal plan to reduce infant mortality nationwide. Kay Johnson is the woman who's heading up the advisory committee for the plan. She says the Affordable Care Act will play a big role. Right now, if you're poor and you're pregnant, you're likely covered by Medicaid. But if you're a low-income woman and you're not pregnant, chances are you don't qualify for Medicaid and you can't afford health insurance on your own.
4 out of 10 low-income women with incomes below 200% of poverty do not have health insurance. 4 out of 10 of them. How can we help women become healthy and come to a pregnancy ready with their own health and well-being that they can give to that pregnancy and to that baby if we're not helping them get preventive care or address their diabetes? So we've failed to invest in women before pregnancy, and it's a big gap in our country.
That is, until now. Kay Johnson says the Affordable Care Act now gives low-income women of childbearing age the opportunity to get well women visits and screenings and preventative services that might stave off chronic conditions like hypertension and diabetes, conditions that are known to lead to preterm and low birth weight babies. Better access to contraception is also part of the health care reform law. If Michigan goes through with its Medicaid expansion as it's written in the Affordable Care Act, some 400,000 to 500,000 people in Michigan who did not qualify before will now have health insurance. Educating parents on safe sleep environments is something Kay Johnson, nearly everybody I spoke to, brought up as something parents can actively do to reduce the risk of sudden infant death syndrome and other sleep-related causes of infant death. The Back to Sleep campaign has been around since the early 90s, and yet nearly a third of all infant deaths in this country are due to SIDS. So there are people like Nurse Amy Candace,
K-A-N-D-E-S,
who check in on moms at their homes right after they've had their baby.
All right, couple questions.
On a recent home visit to a family in southwest Detroit, Candace checks the newborn's weight and color and walks the new parents through what is normal and what is not in terms of the baby's health. She talks with them about feeding, how they're not supposed to heat up infant formula in the microwave, how you can still get pregnant when you're breastfeeding.
You can still get pregnant.
Uh-oh.
Then you have 9 months and a new baby, so be careful.
And then she goes into her SIDS talk.
And then this one is muy importante. This one is dormir boca arriba. This is back to sleep or prevención muerte de cuna.
She explains that tummy time is good, but only when a parent is watching. And that cute little baby hat, that's a no-no. It can fall over the baby's face and suffocate her.
Okay. Nothing in her crib. Nothing. Only the baby. No diapers, no pillows, no bumper pads. These have to come out.
Candace is with the Bright Beginnings program out of the Henry Ford Health System, which some Medicaid providers cover. It's one of the many, many nurse home visiting programs available to women in the state, whether you're a new mom or this is your fifth baby, whether or not you qualify for Medicaid. Another thing you can do to improve your baby's chance of survival? Not smoking during pregnancy is probably the number one preventable risk factor for poor birth outcomes. And yet, in Michigan, about 15% of moms smoke during pregnancy. University of Michigan researcher Katie Gold isn't surprised that women continue to smoke during their pregnancy.
I have had patients on cocaine and smoking, and every single one of them has said to me, oh, cocaine was much easier to quit than tobacco smoking.
What she is surprised about is how many women don't tell their doctors and midwives that they smoke. Studies show about a third of women on Medicaid don't admit to their doctors that they smoke, which means those pregnant moms don't get the counseling to try to stop smoking. So Goal did some focus groups with a bunch of moms who are or were smokers and asked them,
why do women not disclose this? What are they worried about? In general, these women said people should tell their doctors because doctors or midwives could help them quit smoking. They wanted that help, but they were very afraid of the judgment. And they talked about how women look at a pregnant woman as a smoker and think badly of her and think she doesn't care about her child.
Gold says there's a urine test people can take that shows whether or not someone is smoking, regardless of what they may say. So Gold asked the women in her focus group,
what if you had told your doctor you didn't smoke, and then the doctor presented you with something that showed you had a positive test? And the women felt like it might actually open up an opportunity to talk about it, that for some people it might open the door.
And for others it might not. Gold says the doctors and midwives she surveyed were not fans of the idea. Even though Gold said if she did the study, she would tell the women what she was testing for, the doctors and midwives said no, it would violate the patient's trust.
I think it still, in my mind, raises this concern that we're not counseling 30% of women who tell us they're not smoking when they are, and that's not doing a favor to their fetus in the growing pregnancy.
Gold is still sifting through transcripts from the focus groups, so she's not quite clear what her next steps are and whether or not she'll move forward with a clinical trial in the future. When it comes to breastfeeding, the Centers for Disease Control recommends all babies in the U.S. be breastfed exclusively for 6 months or longer. Though that's a pretty tall order, considering the CDC says just over 10% of babies in the U.S. are exclusively breastfed at 6 months. And the rates are particularly low for African-American babies.
Well, most people around my age and younger, they feel like it's nasty. Like, I guess they associate it with, like, sexual, you know. So they just think, like, you know, no, that's what your man's supposed to do or something. So they're weird.
25-year-old Daisha Fluellen is one African-American mom who is bucking the trend. She breastfed her two oldest children until they were 18 months old, and she's currently breastfeeding her littlest one, four-week-old Sincere.
I'm going to try to go 2 years with this one. And I like the bonding time. I like all the nutrients that they get from it.
Fluellen is enrolled in a breastfeeding support group for Medicaid patients at St. John Hospital and Medical Center in Detroit. The group gets together at the hospital every Tuesday. Dr. Paula Schreck runs the breastfeeding support group. She sees breast milk as the ultimate preventative medicine.
If you're talking about poverty, if you're talking about improving the health of a population, where best to start than hour one of life, providing optimal nutrition that's free?
Breastfeeding is a personal choice, of course, and there are a host of reasons why some women don't breastfeed. But studies have shown lots of health benefits associated with breastfeeding. It helps protect babies from infection. Breastfed babies are less likely to develop asthma or become obese. It's even been shown to reduce the risk of SIDS.
The effect on health, it doesn't matter what race you are. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. You can still access the same quality food. And that's a beautiful thing.
Breast milk is free, but Shrek's support group isn't. It's grant-funded. So are the countless other initiatives and programs we've talked about this hour. Saving babies' lives costs money. It isn't free, and there's clearly no silver bullet. But many of the researchers and public health workers I talk to believe we can start to make a difference by focusing not just on what happens in the doctor's office or in the hospital, but what happens in the communities where women and their children live. Dr. Renee Kennedy from the Ingham County Health Department says she'll continue to look for solutions, not just for herself, but for the son she lost many years ago.
Every study you read about, every story you hear about, is not just a, wow, how terrible, but no, that's my neighbor, and that's my friend, and that's my coworker. And if we retain nothing as a society, it is a sense of compassion and connectedness that I think will propel us to solutions. And it's my hope to be looking back one day, long after a retirement, sitting back at 94, saying, wow, infant mortality just rarely happens. We finally figured it out.
You've been listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. This documentary was informed by the Public Insight Network. Thanks to Dustin Dwyer, Sarah Alvarez, and Jordan Medina. Vincent Duffy was our editor. Tamar Charney is the executive producer of State of Opportunity. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jennifer Guerra.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.